Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
Adam, on our show today, we'll be talking with Dr. Bradley Vaughn and Dr. Hei Shin from UNC's Department of Neurology about seizures and epilepsy.
You know, Christy, I'm really excited to have this conversation. As we were kind of talking one day offline, we realized we had never, in the 5 years that we've been doing this show, had a show on seizures.
It's I know, it's shocking.
Wow, considering how important and how frequent these occur.
Yeah, and you know how scary it is to people. So I think this is going to be a great conversation. And thankfully, we have some good research that matters today to get us started. We're going to talk about age-linked memory loss and how that plays out for men and women and risk of dementia.
And hopefully some reassuring news.
Yes.
We're going to talk about the relationship between sleep and sex. Stay tuned for that one.
Mm-hmm. And how many friends do I need for health?
And then finally, when you go to the emergency room, are you likely to get tests that maybe you don't need? Let's just dive right in, Chris, because we got some juicy sorts of research here that matters. And this first one about memory loss is an important study because it I don't know about you, but I hear from my patients all the time, I can't remember names from, you know, or I can't remember some events that I used to, you know, predominantly men, but sometimes women in their 50s, 60s, and 70s, and they say, I'm worried I have Alzheimer's.
I know. It troubles my parents and a lot of my patients as well. And the concern is I can't remember that person's name. I can't remember, you know, just some basic details, or I'm looking for a word and I can't find it. And does this mean I'm going to get dementia? Is this the beginning?
And this was a actual study where they looked at 1,200 adults from Minnesota who were ages between 30 and 95. None of them had dementia. And they did two types of brain scans, the MRI to look at a section of the brain involved in memory, and what's called a PET scan, which is a different type of imaging to look up for plaques called amyloid that could be related to Alzheimer's.
What they found was that both memory and brain volume did gradually decline from age 30 to the mid-60s, but not that many people in the group had a lot of plaque buildup during that time. And it wasn't until around age 70 that there was a lot of buildup of those plaques.
But it found that those who were even carriers for one of these genes that perhaps has been linked to these plaques and some Alzheimer's had no greater decline in memory or brain volume. And really what these researchers say in the end is that the memory loss associated with age is pretty pervasive, and it can be worse for men than women, but it doesn't herald Alzheimer's. So virtually everyone over time will have what we hear commonly is, I can't remember certain names or certain things. That's not Alzheimer's.
Right. And so that's reassuring that it's common and that it happens to most everyone. But the thing, if you're worried about and you want to reduce your risk of developing Alzheimer's or more significant memory problems, is do those same things that reduce your heart disease and stroke risk by lowering your blood pressure and getting control over or losing weight to prevent diabetes.
And quitting smoking and physical activity.
Yep.
Lots of different things that you can control. Talking about things we can control, we've talked about sleep lots on the show, Christy, but I don't know if we've ever talked, and we've talked about
sex
and a sex therapist on the show before, but I don't know if we've talked about sleep and sex in the same study.
We haven't.
We got it now.
This is a juicy study. I will say up front that I don't like the study because it used 171 female college students,
Would you prefer they did female dentist or physicians?
Or just, well, I just think like maybe slightly older, maybe people more likely to be married in monogamous relationships. But
yes, that's the next study that they're going to do.
Okay, and well, they started out with college students.
One at some point in time. But yes, this is a starting place. And what did they find?
So they did questionnaires about sexual distress, depression, anxiety. They followed them over 2 weeks, and they had questionnaires on sexual function over the past 24 hours and sleep quality the night before. So how long did it take them to fall asleep, and how long did they sleep?
And for those that were in a relationship, every extra hour of sleep seemed to relate to higher levels of sexual desire and a higher likelihood of sexual activity the next day, and that those who had slept longer had greater reports of vaginal lubrication during sexual activity than those who had less sleep. And this was published in the online journal, the Journal of Sexual Medicine.
So what they say in the conclusion, the authors say that getting more sleep isn't like the magic fix to couples who are having sexual problems, but that there is some relationship between getting good quality sleep and your sexual health.
And I think it seems pretty natural and self-evident that if you haven't really slept well, the first thing on your mind necessarily isn't, I'd like to have sexual activity. And so it seems like that there's a certain prerequisite. And if you find it in college students, maybe it does hold for other groups, will remain to be seen. But it certainly couldn't hurt to have more sleep.
Okay, so let's move on to how many friends do I need? So, and we're not talking about Facebook friends, we're talking about real friends. This was a huge review done in 2010 looking at the number of friends that people have and some markers with health.
This was in the journal Plus One, a latest review. And they really looked at, is there a factor of social isolation? And we did a whole show on loneliness where we saw that it's a huge predictor of all kinds of adverse outcomes. And here the question is, could one then look at your social networks and say, is there a number in which one should try to develop or think about because it might have real benefits? It's the opposite of what we were looking at in terms of loneliness. This is some engagement.
Right. So socially isolated people are more than twice as likely to die from heart disease as people who have a solid social circle. And that number usually is cited around 150 people, but could range anywhere from 100 and 200, is the approximate size of a person's social circle, or like the people that they would invite family and non-family to a large party.
We're going to have some bigger parties. That's all I can say. Our parties aren't big enough here. But this is a serious question. And it doesn't say, well, how could I increase my social networks? But it does say getting engaged, perhaps with some different circles, different interests, would really have some benefits. And I don't know, Christy, if you have any other advice.
Well, and it says that your closest 15 relationships, and that can include your family members, but also non-family members, seem to be the most important when it comes to both mental and physical health, and that it's your good friends, even sometimes over your brother and sister, who release more of those feel-good blood chemistries, those neuropeptides or those endorphins in your body from laughing or being with friends, then it often is being with your sister or brother. How's that for you?
Well, you know, Christy, I'm not sure I'll go into the family dynamics there, but it does make me think of the Rolling Stones. You can't always get what you want. If you try sometimes, you just might find you get what you need. So we'll just have that music there.
Do you get what you need when you go to the emergency department? That is our next research that matters.
Gracious. Well, this was a research article that was in the journal Academic Emergency Medicine, and they surveyed emergency room doctors, and they said almost all of them, 97%, said that they personally ordered unnecessary imaging tests, and I can just see my mother cringing.
Well, you know, more than 85% of those doctors admitted that in general they do order too many tests, and almost all of them said, personally, I have. So, I mean, part of that is this fear of missing something that would help them figure out what's going on. So, and they have a lot going on at the time, and so order a bunch of tests and maybe it'll help you find the diagnosis. But also it's this fear of malpractice. If you come to the ER and they miss something that possibly could be life-threatening, that then they'll get sued for that. And that really does happen, and it shapes what emergency doctors do.
Yeah, I remember being in the emergency room recently with a loved one, Christy, and they had an EKG done in an outpatient clinic, and an hour later they were in the emergency room, and there was no increased chest pain or anything different. And the ER said, well, we do an EKG because it's what we do when you come in here. And they said, well, I just had one done. I don't want to pay for the extra cost. And they were like, well, you can't refuse a test. And so we do have this blanket way of doing things, And I think we should question. And I think part of what we talked about in a previous show was kind of opening up records, opening up this process, opening up the cost. And it will perhaps lead to better care. Something to think about.
Something to think about. Okay. That concludes the Research That Matters portion of our show. We had a great chance to talk a little bit about dementia and memory, about sleep and sex, about how many friends you need, and about
ER, and maybe talking about do you need the test or not.
We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll be talking with Dr. Bradley Vaughn and Dr. Hei Shin from UNC's Department of Neurology about seizures and epilepsy. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're talking with Dr. Bradley Vaughn and Dr. Haewon Shin from the University of North Carolina's Department of Neurology about seizures and epilepsy, a really common problem.
Yeah, thanks for being with us, Dr. Vaughn and Dr. Shin.
Thank you for having us.
Good to be here. Thank you.
As a way of introduction for our listeners and because we're fascinated by people, tell us what got you so fascinated in seizures and epilepsy to pursue that in your career.
Well, let's see. When I was in neurology resident, I took care of many patients with epilepsy, and I always thought the disorder was very fascinating. One of the things about epilepsy in the 1980s was it was one of the few disorders in neurology that we had a wide range of therapies for it, and actually was one of the venture points for new therapies in neurology and understanding how the brain worked. So I thought it was a very, very interesting subspecialty to examine not only function of the brain, but also how we may treat brain disorders.
Okay, and how about you, Dr. Shin?
Well, my case was a little bit more personal. While I was traveling with my best friend, she ended up having first-time convulsive seizure in the car on the passenger seat in front of me. So that was make me interested in what is a seizure and what the patient is actually going through, and realize there are so many different treatment options, as Dr. Vaughn just said. And this is probably the only neurological disorder can even have potential curative therapy. So that's why I was getting very interested in about epilepsy.
Well, you know, what's interesting, I think, to Christy and myself as practicing family doctors is we have a lot of patients that have seizures, or we worry about seizures when people come in the hospital, and children and febrile seizures. Unbelievable. Help us understand a little bit about, Dr. Shin, how common are seizures? And maybe, Dr. Vaughn, tell us just like, you know, the you have to know from little children to people at the end of their lives in terms of seizures and cancer. So maybe you can answer two different questions for us. Dr. Shin?
Okay. So as you mentioned, the seizure and epilepsy are very common disorder. Recently, CDC published the prevalence. About 5.1 million patients in the United States has been affected by seizure and epilepsy. The prevalence of lifetime of having at least one seizure on the patient is about 10%. So this is
wow.
Very common.
So most people will likely know someone or someone in their family or friends who's had a seizure.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
Wow.
And tell us, I think we want to get a picture of what seizures are, I think. A lot of people, you use this word and they know something's happening in the brain. There's some shaking involved maybe. But how do you explain to people what is a seizure? And then maybe we can talk a little bit about the range of her life.
Christy, that's a really, really great way to enter into the discussion that Adam had brought up about what the ranges are. You know, epileptic seizures are where part of or all of the brain cells start firing independently, and they fire in such a way, in a pathological manner or an abnormal manner, that they become synchronized. Instead of having the multiple conversations that occur in the brain, these neurons all do the same thing at the same time. And that's what happens in an epileptic seizure, is that the neurons are doing all the same things at the same time.
So everything's firing.
Everything's firing for at least one part of the brain or the whole brain.
Why is that a bad thing? Because in general, we think, God, if all my cells are firing together, they're all working together, I'm doing something that I can't do.
But in this really case, great question.
It's not good.
Well, so when you think of electrical activity in the brain, it's kind of like listening to 1,000 different conversations in the next room. So when you listen to that, when all that information is going back and forth, it should be kind of a buzz. But what happens in a seizure is one person starts to sing, and then another joins in, and another joins in, and another joins in. And so all of the people are singing, but they're not transferring information back and forth. So the difference in a seizure is that instead of having those conversations that neurons are supposed to have, the neurons are actually doing all the same thing and not getting the work done that they would normally get work.
And if I started singing, I can tell you that some people would have seizures.
We would all start
singing. And you put 1,000 people like myself singing, oh my goodness, problems.
And so if all the brain, all the cells in a particular part of the brain are firing, it might make a certain limb or certain body part start to shake.
You're absolutely right. So we talk about seizures in different ways. You can have simple focal seizures. Mm-hmm. Those are seizures where the person remains awake and conscious, and they have memory for the whole event. So in those kind of seizures, they may have a specific movement, as you said, like shaking of a certain limb, or they may have a sensation like a sense of water or heat. They may even be unable to speak for a time period. They may see a certain image in their vision. All of those can occur. There are other seizures that are focal but involve a bigger part of the brain so that the person actually has impaired consciousness. They're not awake through the whole thing, or they don't lay down memory for the whole event. And in those events, they can have more types of behaviors, or they may just stop and not move. They may have a little bit of lip smacking or a stare off. But the key is that they've lost consciousness or they've lost some sort of memory. Now, most of us, when we think of seizures, epileptic seizures, we think of the big seizures. And that's where somebody typically will stiffen and shake all over. But there are other kinds of generalized seizures too. So childhood absence epilepsy, in that disorder, children will just stop, stare for a few seconds. And for those patients, they may have hundreds of events every
well,
day.
Unfortunately, you described something that goes from my children all the way into adolescence and up, yep. This kind of stopping and staring, which this ability to think through, is it a seizure? Mm-hmm. And because mm-hmm. there's a lot of behaviors that it may be difficult. I mean, you describe something as a simple seizure, but to me it doesn't sound like there's anything really simple about that. And it seems like that this is incredibly scary, like Dr. Shen, you mentioned your encounter. So let's talk about the fear factor. It seems like this mm-hmm. provokes tremendous fear. I know as doctors, thinking about my patient have seizure is very fearful for me and from patients. Tell us, Dr. Shen, from your perspective, how does the fear really manifest itself? And what do you do about that to patients?
Well, I mean, if anybody witnessed the seizure from the patient, they will know what the family member is going through. It's a very scary experience. And it's not just for the convulsive seizures, but also even non-convulsive seizures, that patient all of a sudden behave unusually and in a strange manner. And they cannot really control their behavior, and those can be very fearful. I have a patient who had seizure, and after the seizure became very disoriented and very agitated and almost trying to run into the highway. And it was not under her control or his control, but because of the confusion and the disorientation after the seizure made the person to do that. So seizure itself can be very dangerous. When the patient have a seizure, they can get into the potential risk of injury because they fall from seizure or they did something that they are not aware of.
Or if they're driving a car.
Exactly. So they are prone to have an injury. But also, as you know, the brain controls our whole body, controls our, you know, breathing pattern, controls our heart. And after the seizure, even small seizure, the focal seizure, patients all of a sudden can stop breathing or their heart can stop and can die from it, even without any obvious injury. So seizure can be a really serious health problem and can put the patient at the risk of injuries, also premature death.
Well, we want to be sure to talk about how you counsel patients and resources you give them to deal with those fears and the good news that you alluded to at the beginning of so many treatments and options for patients to manage seizures and be able to carry on with their lives. But we do need to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue talking with our guests, Dr. Bradley Vaughn and Dr. Haewon Shin from UNC Departments of Neurology about seizures and epilepsy. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Bradley Vaughn and Dr. Haewon Shin from UNC's Department of Neurology about seizures, about epilepsy. And before the break, we talked a little bit about how common it is to have seizures, what they are, where the brain is firing all at once, or a part of the brain is. And then some of the scary process of being a family member or a person who's experiencing sort of a sudden seizure. Give us, you alluded to good news about treatment options and other things. Give us a little bit more about the good news about having seizures.
Yeah, I think one of the things you brought up a little bit before was a really good point about how do we address the fears. And I think for most patients and their families, the fear element is that loss of control, the unpredictability of having the seizures. And even the seizures themselves, most seizures are relatively brief, less than 3 minutes or so. But it's that inability to predict when is it going to occur that always kind of lurks in the back of both the patient's mind and the family's mind that really gives us the hard issues. And I think first element of trying to deal with that is to talk about the variety of therapies that we have, things both that the patient can do and is under their control, and the types of medicines or other options that we have. In anybody who has epilepsy, the first part is actually taking good care of yourself. So making sure that you're getting good sleep, that the nutritional status is really good, so you're eating regularly, eating good meals, you're not overindulging in alcohol, not using any recreational drugs, and overall making sure that you exercise and stay in a relatively good overall pattern.
Sounds like a family doc, by the way.
Adam, I'm glad you brought that up. For most medical illnesses, if you take good care of yourself, you are more likely to do well with that chronic condition.
Mm-hmm.
The second part is trying to figure out what medications we should start and going through the options, because we do have a variety of medications now in epilepsy, over 20-some different types of medications that we can use and that have been approved by the FDA. And they bring both strengths and they also bring some risks with them. Every medication has its own risk. There are some medicines that we typically start with more commonly, things like a medication called lamotrigine, which we know, especially for females, has a very low risk for birth defects. So that actually is a reasonable medication for both focal onset seizures and primary generalized seizures. And we know that that actually works for focal onset epilepsy about 2 out of 3 times. Then we'll think of other medications that we may need to add on, either older medicines or newer medicines, because there's a variety of potential there. And usually what we try to do is match the next medicines with what other problems the patient may have. So there are some medicines that are for epilepsy that also may help pain disorders, or there are some that may help other mood issues. So elevation of depression.
So, this medications is a tremendously complex but highly specialized to individualize, it sounds like, the medicine to the type of seizure to the other conditions of the patient. I wonder, Dr. Shan, if you could mention about medications that people need to be aware of that could either cause a seizure, make it more likely, because there's so many other things that people are taking. What should we be aware of? And maybe you think of a patient that you've had where you uncovered something that might be helpful for our listeners.
Mm-hmm. So as you mentioned, there are certain medications can lower seizure threshold, and also certain substance like alcohol and some drugs can also lower seizure threshold.
And when you say lower seizure threshold, you mean makes it easier for somebody who has seizures to have
exactly,
a seizure.
Exactly. So everybody has a seizure threshold. If anybody try to push one person too hard, they can have a seizure. So that's why we said seizure threshold.
Mm-hmm.
When we are seeing the patient in a clinic for the potential seizure and epilepsy, we really evaluate very carefully about their other medical history and also medication list, because there are certain medications could potentially lower seizure threshold and make them to have a seizure. And if we identify that, usually we try to advise to stop it if it is possible. I mean, certain conditions, they may not. Then we'll try to see if that will help. If not, then we will think about those patients, do they really need anti-seizure medications to help them to not to have a seizure.
And how often can people get off anticonvulsants? Because, I mean, you just raised that question there. If they've been on them, we worry about, you know, we think about this all the time. You know, they haven't had a seizure in 2 years. Can we just stop it?
Ah, that's a great question.
The Holy Grail.
I don't, by the way.
Yeah, a lot depends upon the patient. So let's say I have a person who's a middle-aged individual who has to drive. Then they have to weigh the possibility of not driving for a period of time when they come off the medication. We typically taper it over 6 weeks. And then, we won't even think about coming off medication unless they're at least 2 years seizure-free.
2 years, okay.
Two years seizure-free. But for some people, remember that they may very well have a high risk of another seizure if they come off. And we look at things like how hard was it to get them controlled in the first place? Do they have a neurological deficit? Do they have something abnormal in their MRI? Or is there an EEG pattern that would predict that they'd have another seizure?
And when a person comes in with a first-time seizure, you're doing a big evaluation for all kinds of things that it could have been from, but maybe you can't find a direct reason. Mm-hmm. How do you counsel that person on, one, whether or not they need to be on medicines for the next several years, and two, what's the chance they're going to have another one? I mean, these are all kinds of unknowns, and how do you counsel that patient?
Right. That is a really good question, Christine. So usually when the patient has a seizure, we try to look for the etiology. Why did this patient have a seizure? Is it because patients underwent to the, you know, heavy alcohol drinking and sleep deprivation? I mean, or was this patient got really ill and sick and had a seizure? Or was there any other etiology like structural problem in the brain or traumatic brain injury or infection? So we try to evaluate very carefully about those things. And then also we evaluate the patient with the EEG to see if they have any underlying pattern that can potentially have a higher risk of another seizure. So for the patient who we cannot identify any etiology and all of those extensive evaluation came back normal, their chance of having another seizure in their lifetime is relatively low, about 20 to 30% chance. However, if the patient who has potential risk of seizure, like either structural abnormality or neurological examination was abnormal or EEG finding was abnormal, those patients, their chance of second seizure in their lifetime dramatically goes up, anywhere from 60 to 80%.
You know, in just a few seconds, Dr. Vaughn, I know if we go from the other extreme, from the folks who may not have again to the people who are having it so many times, tell us about real briefly the role of surgery, and then also maybe just what are the final things that you might like our listeners to know?
Yeah, I think the important part is that once a person fails two trials of medication that were appropriate for their seizure type, the likelihood that medication's going to keep their seizures under control is very, very low, well under 10%. And at that point, they really do need to be seen by a person in an epilepsy center and evaluated for epilepsy surgery. There are some types of epilepsy surgery, like temporal lobectomy, with certain conditions that well over 3 out of 4 patients will be seizure-free. Dr. Shin's actually an expert in epilepsy surgery. I don't know if you have anything to add to that.
Well, I mean, about 1/3 of patients in having epilepsy, we cannot control their seizure. It's not because we don't have any medication, but their seizure is just very difficult to control. And among those patients, if we can identify potentially one location of seizure focus, which is amenable for the surgical resection, those patients can really benefit from epilepsy surgery. Some patients, for example, like, you know, benign tumor, low-grade tumor patients, their seizure freedom rate can go up to 80 to 90% if we can offer the epilepsy surgery.
Well, it's like if you could go into my vocal cord and get rid of that song. You know exactly where to isolate it and remove it. Well, this has been a fascinating discussion, and I do know that we have so many take-home messages from today's session, and perhaps we could put some links on our website about the surgery options, maybe a couple medications to be aware of, and some other messages of some readings that perhaps our listeners could go to.
Do you have a particular reference that you send patients to for information?
Well, the American Epilepsy Society actually has a very good web page and certainly has a lot of information.
Great. We'll post that on our blog as well.
And also Epilepsy Foundation has a really great information about different epilepsy surgery options and the medications and the first aid information to the patients and family.
Fantastic. We've been talking with Dr. Bradley Vaughn and Dr. Haewon Shin. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you all so much.
It's been a great time.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I will spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and your concerns.
If you have any question or comment you'd like us to address on an upcoming show, send this comment to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our executive producer, Erica Norrie, to read us our very first House Call question today about someone who's got a tremor or shaking.
My father had a tremor in his hand years ago. I noticed that I'm now developing that same tremor, and I know it's not Parkinson's. Can you tell me about the treatment, how well it works, and the side effects?
Thank you for sharing your question, and I'm sorry that that's something, I guess it's reassuring to you that you saw that your father had this and now you have it, so perhaps it's not as scary, but it can be troublesome to people, both because they're worried it's something more serious or because it's bothersome if your hand is shaking all the time.
And you probably know it's not Parkinson's, perhaps because you spoke with someone or the symptoms don't match it. And maybe this tremor kind of gets worse when you start to do something versus the tremor of the Parkinson's sometimes gets better when you try to do something. So you don't have the other symptoms of Parkinson's. And maybe this tremor is called what's called an essential tremor. And I'm not quite sure why it's called essential because it doesn't seem to me to be essential to living. But it is. That's what it's called. And it's kind of a tremor that really can be bothersome because it sometimes is hard to pick up a cup of coffee or hot drink or while you're eating. And it could be embarrassing. Different things like that.
Yeah. And the most common, perhaps, treatment for this category of medicine called beta blockers. And these are medicines that people take sometimes for blood pressure or heart, sometimes for like performance anxiety before speaking. But it also helps with people who have a resting tremor. And sometimes you can start on a really low dose to reduce your chance of side effects and then increase it as high as you need to control that tremor.
And there's lots of different beta blockers. Sometimes when people have heard the names propranolol, Inderol, Atenolol, the different sorts of names there. Generic ones would seem to work pretty well. But you want to talk with your doctor about that because there are also other treatments that probably have more side effects. There's a couple seizure medicines, one called primidone that seems to work sometimes when the beta blocker doesn't work, a medicine called Neurontin, which is used sometimes for people who have nerve problems and diabetes but can work in this condition but can make you drowsy.
Yeah, and I would most people would start out with the beta blocker because if you can tolerate that and it doesn't make you too tired and it does the trick, then that's probably your best bet in terms of thinking about the risk reduction and profile.
You know what sometimes works, but we don't really recommend it as a treatment?
What's that?
Alcohol. Sometimes a shot of alcohol or beer or a glass of wine temporarily makes them better. I hear that from patients all the time, and there's some evidence that. But we're not going to go around recommending that you drink alcohol six times a day.
Not a good idea.
But if you're in a short-term basis that you were going out into a social situation, a glass of wine might improve it. So that's something to be aware of.
Okay, interesting. Let's take our next house call question. Erica?
I've had UTIs for over a decade without real causes being found. About a year ago, I went to my doctor and she put me on Macrobid, one of the few medications that seems to work for me. I've taken one a day for the last year, and I wonder how long should I stay on it? I should mention that I'm prone to infections.
Well, we should mention that a UTI is a urinary tract infection. So that's a common problem and a difficult one, particularly when you have it lots of times and you can't really find out what's causing it.
And it's more common in women. And the people who get it sometimes will get them over and over again. And so taking an antibiotic like Macrobid is a common thing to do for people who have these recurrent infections. Some people will just take one right after sexual activity. If that's something that prompts getting a urinary tract infection, then just doing that can then ward off the UTI without having to take it every day. But other people do need to take a low dose every day to try to prevent those infections.
The good news about Macrobid is it is perhaps less common for it to develop resistance, but on the long-term basis, it could have serious side effects. You can have scarring of the lung, what's called pulmonary fibrosis for long-term use. So, you know, a tough question about how long you should be on it and could you try getting off of it and see perhaps that things have changed or maybe actually go and see your primary care doctor or a specialist and see perhaps they've missed something. Maybe there's some other reason that could find out why you've got it and maybe prevent them because, boy, you don't want to develop resistance to the antibiotics. That could be treacherous.
I completely agree. Wish you all the best. Let's take our next house call question.
I've heard Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on your talk show about taking probiotics when antibiotics are already being taken. Does this really work, or is this just another ad by an advertising company?
Great question.
Well, we can tell you for certain it's not right now for our show an ad by another advertising company. We might wish that because then we would be having wonderful commercial support for our radio show. But right now we don't have that.
That's right.
We're not being influenced and we're not getting paid by this. But I think we do worry about antibiotic-associated diarrhea and side effects. And so we're really intrigued by research on things like probiotics that may have some benefits.
So the idea, for those of you who haven't thought this through, is that when you take antibiotics, sort of wipes out the normal bacteria in your body, and in this case we're talking about the colon, and then you might be more prone to get diarrhea and other overgrowths of bacteria that maybe shouldn't be so prevalent in your colon. So some people will take these probiotics to sort of put that bacteria back in your body in the context of taking antibiotics. Do you do this regularly if you were taking antibiotics?
Well, I had to take some antibiotics for the first time in about 20 years recently, Christy, and I did start them because I was concerned, and it caused us both to then look up some of the evidence. And one of the problems in this is that the studies have been pretty small. They have limitations. We don't know the whole dose and the activity. We do know that some of the probiotics are some of the things one finds in the yogurt cultures and some of those, but it depends on perhaps the condition, and we know that to maybe reduce antibiotic-associated diarrhea, it may have a benefit. We don't know if it's cost-effective. Things like infectious diarrhea, it may have a little bit more benefit. And then most other conditions, we don't really know if it works or not. The question is, does it have side effects either?
Right. So there's really not enough evidence for us to say, oh, everyone who takes antibiotics should be taking probiotics. It probably isn't going to hurt you, but I wouldn't spend a lot of money on it. And I personally don't do it, not because I think it's wrong, just because it just it's not high priority.
Have you had to take antibiotics in the last couple of years?
I had to take them once, and I didn't have any problems.
Yeah,
but.
Yeah. Well, this is one of those things that maybe you can talk with your doctor, find out what your doctor does, and then see and ask why. And that'll conclude Your Health Today. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns that are important to you. You can send us your questions and comments at yourhealth@unc.edu. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, Health App, or visit us online at yourhealthradio.org.
We want to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guests today, Dr. Bradley Vaughn and Dr. Haitian. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
I'm Dr. Christy Page, and we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.